morning we're going to talk about sex style. Talk about the gyre of sex, or one sex. In this case, it's the first double figure. It's made up of two trines. The square is made up of two oppositions, but oppositions are straight lines, and those are not geometric figures. Now, we could talk, and we will for a very few minutes, about the number five and the pentacle or the pentagram. That does have an astrological influence, but it is very mild, and you have to have very exact orbs, and it deals with things that, astrologically speaking, that are not easily understood in life. The arithmetic and the geometry about the number five is very beautiful. It's found in a lot of things. And it talks about aspects of soul growth. It would be too much to go into the geometry of it, because it's a rather long presentation. You have to describe how break up a line means an extreme, which means you break up a line into two segments. That's a little bit off, so that the small segment is proportional to the large section in the same way that the large section is proportional to the whole business. And it's the whole principle of analogy. That's called dividing a line means and extremes, and such a line is called a golden section. And you can't produce a five-pointed star without having produced a golden section. In esoteric astrology, the pentagon and the pentacle have a lot to do with states that are between the spirit and matter. That is soul states. The number five is associated with gold, as the golden section is called, and it has to do with your gold soul material, such that people who have golden auras are people who have done a lot of service and have harvested a lot of the soul material out of their daily experiences. Dividing a line means an extreme is the principle of analogy. This is to this as this is to this. And it is by that analogical reasoning, which is actually a restatement of the principle of analogy. The Hermetic axiom, as above, so below, that things are absorbed into the spirit. Analogy is a consequence of the unity of the spirit, the same truth that permeates everything. And even though conditions may be different on different planes, there is something analogous, because it's the same spirit that is in all those planes of existence. The arithmetic of the number five is associated with what is called the Fibonacci series. And it's found everywhere in nature. It has to do with the rate that things grow at, for example. It's great in my garden. I can watch it every year. The leaves, by proportion, by steps, keep getting bigger and bigger. If you have like an infinitely long growing season, the proportion would get much bigger, and I'd have collard greens like that. You're with a garden fanatic. Since it's about gold, soul gold, we're talking about activities that are in between material awakeness and spiritual awakeness. And the pentacle, or the pentagon, or the quintile, or the biquintile, are all about things that have to do with states in between, such as when you're out of the body, or or in between lives or things like that. It's very subtle and it's very hard to work with. Soul material, the compounding of soul material in the cosmos is always done on the microcosmic level. And that's one of the things that the soul compounding on the macrocosmic level is comprised of the work that is done on the microcosmic level. And for this reason, the five-pointed star has always been the symbol of the microcosm, usually of human beings, so that we see these pictures from the alchemists with the body of the five-pointed star, the vertical point being above the head and then the arms at an angle and the feet at an angle like that. The six-pointed star, since it covers everything, since it covers all four elements and it covers them in a very harmonious way, the six-pointed star is associated with the macrocosm. And we're eventually going to get back to it. In fact, let's start going into that now. This is, we're talking about the pentacle. If you want to go into it and do some of the geometry of it, it's a good way to learn astrology and some very good mathematical philosophy. I'm trying to whet your curiosity so that you dig into it.
I'm sorry, which one did you relate to the macrocosm?
The six points. Now, as we've gone through the simple aspects and the numbers and geometric figures that are associated with them, we have given each of them classic rulers, like the trine always being Venusian, or the conjunction always being Saturnian or solar. Now, each of the numbers builds on each other like counting, and each of the geometric ten principles builds on each other. And we're going to find that the same, that in the same way, the relationship of the hexagon to the other geometric figures we've looked at is follows that same pattern. Now, the numbers that are related with geometric figures are the way people understood the world. The first people to work with this were the Pythagoreans. And the Pythagoreans used dots in order to understand geometric figures. They didn't have such a thing as an algebra. All they had were ratios and numbers. And so they looked at different kinds of numbers that were necessary to produce different kinds of figures. Like, for example, this is a sequence that is square numbers. One squared is one, two squared is two, and then by adding another number always, the square number of three was nine. Morning, Jay. Now, they did the same thing with triangular numbers. And triangular numbers, because they have to do with harmonious states of consciousness, with spiritual states of consciousness, were more important to the behavior of the Pythagoreans than the square numbers. This is a series of triangular numbers. Everything always goes back to one. Second triangular number is three. Next one is six. And the Pythagorean number was for 10. So when you're talking about the number 10, this was the sacred decad. The base of the 10 is 4, and things work up to 1. Now, if you've ever, in Western culture, they say when you're getting angry, you should count to 10. You were told things like that. Mm-hmm. And by the time you got to 10, you would have cooled off enough so that you wouldn't do drastic things while you were angry. And this goes right back to Pythagoreans. But they didn't count from 1 to 10. They counted from 10 to 1. And what they were doing, the four dots on the base of the triangle were the four principles of the material world. We talked about that one, we talked about the square. The three dots were associated with the threefold spirit. And then the two was the known and the unknown, and the great cosmic womb of all creation, and then the one brought you back to the one. And you ended up contemplating the one, and by then, you were in such a state that you couldn't be angry with anyone or anything. So that's the kind of thing they did.
Let's look at your diagram. Is that the origin of bowling?
What?
Bowling.
May very well be. May very well be.
Because there's one, the ball, and then you've got the pins. The 10.
Yeah. That's 10-pin bowling. Unfortunately, there was also a 9-pin bowling. May have had to do with a diamond kind of bowling. The 9 is associated with the diamond because mm-hmm. that's where you have a base that functions in two directions.
Where was 9-pin bowling?
Canada, they have it, I think.
Really?
Yeah. I believe that in 9-pin bowling, it's a little bit smaller. Mm-hmm. The pins are a little bit smaller.
That's yes. Also called nut pin, I think.
You don't put your fingers in holes in the ball.
Yeah. Usually for kids to start.
You learn things when you get outside of middle. Now, this is what the Pythagoreans were instructed to do. And a lot of the mystery schools going deep into the Orient, but certainly in classical times in Greece were based on the bones. That the bones were where the blood was developed. When you say, I have a feeling in my bones, you are relating to the deepest spiritual aspect. So the bones relate to the father, especially the heart of the bones, where the marrow is and the blood is produced. And the blood is ruled by the life spirit, and the nerves and such are ruled by the human spirit. And so to draw the consciousness into the bones, oftentimes they would repeat poetry while they were squeezing their bones. Because, you know, like a broken bone is an indication of someone not being able to get cosmic forces deep into their physical body. They're not completely incarnated. And this is why in the prophets and in the Bible, a big deal is made about Jesus that not a bone was broken. Meaning to say that the incarnation was so perfect that it went into the depth of every atom, and that consciousness was brought in that way. So that, like for example, in the Mysteries of Heracles in ancient Greece, they had poems that were something like mantras, only they were a step forward more in the intellectual direction, and they would chant or sing those poems while they were touching their fingers. And this is where, in poetry, the dactyl is Greek for finger, where the dactylic measure was found. And so with the Pythagoreans, they did it on their hand. The upper part of the thumb has to do with the assertion of will, and the tapered part in the center has to deal with intelligence. And those were considered, this the part down here, the heavy part is associated with Venus, but the part that is the thumb proper is, was associated with the things that we can freely do. As free human beings, we can express our will and we can express our intellect, and they are opposed. And beings that have the opposed finger can do all of the things of manipulations. So the Pythagoreans would go, they would count 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, and they would go off like that. I'm convinced that I have a Pythagorean background from past lives because I've been doing things like that all of my life, even before I knew there was a Pythagoras. I still do it to this day. If I'm in a tense situation where there isn't something occupying my mind, I'll even touch my body in such a way that I make, I'll touch my face or something like that in ways that I'm making the Decad, the triangle of Pythagoreans. That's all very interesting, but it's not getting us very far with that. So you end up contemplating complete unity. The sextile, or the six, or the hexagon, or the hexacle, is called the Star of David. And it is the first compound figure that we have that we use in the aspects. It is made up of two equilateral triangles. Center of the circle being the focus for everything. Now, we said earlier that the square is also compound, but it's compound of two lines, and it's not the same thing as having two geometric figures. This means that there's something unique and something different about the sextile than all the other aspects that we use. In fact, first of all, let's look into the mathematics of it. All of astrology and the aspects of astrology are called sesamajisal, meaning to say that they go back, they're back to divisions by 60. In astrology, there are two number systems that are used. There is the quadrate number system, and that is 45 degrees, if you call it the semi-sextile, 90, 135, 180, 0. It's called quadrate because these are squares or semi-squares or parts of squares. And this includes the conjunction, the square, opposition, semi-sextile, if you want to do that, and what is it called? Sesquisquare. The other system, which deals with the positive aspects, that all the sextiles and trines, is called sesamajisal, and that involves 0, 30, 60, skip to 90, and 120. It's a double image all of the way. And there's a totally different feeling about them. The square system of the quadrate system of numbers, it has to do with harsh forcing things to be accomplished. Whereas the sesamajisal always has a harmony about it. And so when we're talking about the sextile, we're talking about something is harmonious. But because you have, you know, I'm a bachelor, and I'm really a hardcore bachelor. And as I become older, I become more and more of a hardcore bachelor. It's really nice to form a team and to do something in complete harmony with someone else. And that's a good lesson of growing up. And I think very highly of marriage. But relative to getting something done, a marriage or a group of people are inefficient. And if you happen to be hyper-masculine, like I am, I want to get things done, and that's really important to me. If you're all alone, there's nothing to stop you. Unfortunately, you're myopic and you only see things from one point of view. You can see John Hempstead, who was up, who you gave the talk yesterday afternoon. He's really well married, because when he gives a talk, it isn't just John Hempstead. It's John Hempstead and the group. He always engages other people because he doesn't want to be all alone by himself. And he's someone that believes of working together with other people because he's done it all of his life. And the same thing happens when you come to the sextile. If you have two geometric figures, it's harder to get something done. And this is why the influence of the sextile is so wild. I know of astrologers that will not use a sextile with an orb that is larger than 4 degrees. And I even met one man who was a really qualified genius, a very, very super intelligent man, and he wouldn't do anything with a sextile with an orb that was more than 3 degrees. I think that's warranted in some ways, but I think it's a little bit extreme. So what we're talking about here are the pleasant feelings. When we talked about the trine, we said that 3/8 music or 3/4 music was always felt good. It was always lilting, always positive, and it was always a pleasant kind of thing. And the same thing is true with the 6/8 music. The only difference is that 6/8 music is more complex. It has a secondary accented beat, and it has that longer measure of accomplishing something. So there, so the 6/8 music is very lilting, but there's an intellectual element. Da 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 da. You know, you've heard music like that. Da 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 da. Back in the, I think it was back in the 60s. It was a famous rock song that was on the charts for weeks. It was on the charts because it had that sophistication of the sextile. If I'm not mistaken, I think most of the poems of Emily Dickinson can be sung to 6/8 metrics. Yeah, I think quite a few of them.
It has a very good name.
Yeah, well, yes.
So the sextile 60s?
Somebody said that, told me once that Emily Dickinson would bloom for them forever, because the poetry of Emily Dickinson can also, almost all of it, fit perfectly into the Yellow Rose of Texas.
Yes, I heard that. It's only from you years ago, and I couldn't read it anymore. Now you've done it again.
There are things. But that's the kind of quality that it has. Now, the sextile, when there is a sextile aspect, it happens between adjacent vertices in the double triangle. This means that the sextile is always between complementary elements, fire and air, or earth and water. There are some cases when you're on the edges of signs at the very beginning or very end that that isn't the case. But what we're talking about is a complementation. If you see this in a lot of Hermetic symbolism, usually the triangle that is pointing up is white, whereas the triangle that is pointing down is black. And between those two extremes of complete spiritual enlightenment and complete material darkness, everything else, the whole spectrum is formed. In fact, Goethe, the poet, has his own system of color. And he believes that all of the colors are an interaction between light, the white and black. It's not the Newtonian view of color. the Newtonian view of color things is only wavelength. And for years the physicists have poo-pooed Goethe, but the idea is that a theory that explains more things without having extraneous or unnecessary elements is a better theory. And it turns out that in modern physics, Rod, the man that gave the talk earlier this week, he's been a professor of physics at one time of his life, as well as a professor of mathematics and a professor of engineering. And he says that now in our times, there is a paper in physics that demonstrates that the theory of Goethe explains things that the Newtonian theory does not explain, and that they are phenomena that you can see for yourself. And it is a theory that is not abstractly mathematical. It is a theory that the participation of the viewer is part of the proof of the theory and part of what he's demonstrating. I said, Ugo Camerini, I said, because Ugo Camerini one time said, Ugo Camerini is a professor of physics. And he said to me once, he was interested in mysticism, we were walking down the hall. He says, Goethe was a very fine man, but he didn't know about color. And then, so I said, as a shot over the bow, I sent to him, do you want the paper that demonstrates that Goethean color theory describes things? He never answered. All right. So what we're talking about is complementation. In complementation, there is fulfillment. But the complementation that is with the sextile, it is not the only kind of complementation. It's not the only time that there is complementary vibrations between fire and air or between earth and water. The opposition. Aries is fire, equilibra is air. And that is a different kind of a complementation. It is a complementation that produces a perfect fulfillment. Everything that one is, the other isn't. Or everything that is needed by one comes from the other. So, for example, in a horoscope, the greatest compatibility between people for a marriage, personal compatibility, not emotional or other kinds of compatibility, the greatest compatibility is if two people have opposite rising signs. You are a very lucky person. You've earned it probably from past lives. But you're very fortunate if you have a partner who perfectly complements you that way. But the complementation that comes from the sextile is a different kind of the sextile. The effect of it is very different. In one case, you're seeing yourself in a mirror image. In the other case, something more happens with the sextile and you have a completely different universe and you're just not on a pole with each other directing back and forth. When you're seeing things with a completely different view of the universe, there's something that is not only fulfilling, but it's expansive. The opposition is not expansive. The opposition is not an expansive aspect. In fact, and sometimes people don't get anywhere with the opposition. It's just back and forth and they never make up their mind. That's been the complaint. I have a lot of oppositions in my horoscope, and two of them are two planets in the seventh house, and that's been a complaint of every woman I've ever been. If you can't ever make up your mind, I never would have been married if my wife had told us this. She went out with one of my best friends right in front of me. Wow, that was just devastating. And she would just wouldn't come back when I was bleeding. If she had come back one day later, I probably would have been enough over there's a deadlock. There's a deadlock that is in the opposition, but there is an expansion. And there is a creation when you have the sextile. The two triangles are point for point like each other because they are what is called a symmetry across the center. Which is like one triangle, if you take it and pull it right through the center and out the other side, you get the other triangle. That's the only way I can describe it without trying to logic or mathematics. So what we're talking about then is a symmetry is a positive way of looking at things that gives you a unique outlook that is different than if you are within a simple geometric figure. You have two kinds of consciousness being blended together with each other in a way that you feel relaxed. When you're relaxed and you've got the big view of the whole universe, then you can get unique insights into the way things happen. Now, classically, that expansion is Jupiterian. And normally, a classic sextile is ruled by Jupiter, and the creation that comes out of it is ruled by Venus. But since we've already looked at Venus and Jupiter trines to get the feel of the trine, I thought we would do something else to look at the sextile. I want to look at the creative aspects of it and the unique aspects of it. It's one of those things like looking at a kaleidoscope. You turn that, and it's such a simple thing. And you know, you think that you get bored with it really quickly, and you think you wear out all the combinations, but every time you turn it, it still has the same kind of fascination. And that's what the sextile is like. So I thought I'd talk about the Uranian qualities of it. And in order to do that, we're going to look at sextiles that are mandalic. Now, 2 years ago in summer school, we talked about the lunation cycle. The new moon, back to the new moon, if you looked at the aspects of the sun and the moon in the lunation cycle, to get an understanding of what the 29-day month was like, how each day is different from each other day, and that the special points like the new moon, the full moon, the quarter moon, and such, are special changing points on the consciousness in the cycle. And when we did that, we put the sun on the ascendant and we said it was there permanently. And then we put the moon successively on each of the constellations, each of the houses, and we saw aspects for each house cusp. Well, we actually wouldn't really have to do that at all. If we put the rulers of the planets on the house cusp, we would get a mandalic outlook about things. Thus, if we put Mars on the ascendant, or at the vernal equinox, then the relation of every planet to it would talk in a classic way, not the classic way, but a classic way, about the nature of the aspect. Now, some people would say, but that would mean that all of the aspects are ruled by Mars. And in a way, that is true. Because if you go back to what we said in the very first day of these talks, we said the aspects are how things get done. They are tools. They are means of applying energy to accomplish things. And the energy planet, the planet that does the root hard work, is Mars. So if we want to understand the sextile, we look at Mars, there are two possible sextiles. One would be the sextile to Uranus as the ruler of Aquarius. And so Mars sextile Uranus would tell us something about the creative aspects of the sextile, whereas the Mars sextile to Mercury, where Mercury is on the cusp of the third house, would be the elementary proficiency, which is the reading, writing, and arithmetic house, that kind of education. It's elementary proficiency, and sometimes the elementary proficiency is called beginner's luck. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look mostly at Mars sextile Uranus, but we're going to also look at Mars sextile Mercury just to get a flavor of that. But because we're doing this mandalically, we have to be very correct about it. We have to take cases where Uranus is backwards in the zodiac from Mars. And that is to say that the shortest the shortest distance from Mars to Uranus is backwards in the zodiac, not forward. If it were the other way around, if Mars were here and Uranus would be here, that wouldn't be the way it occurs mandalically. So what we're doing is, this is called a first sextile, because the slowest planet indicates the first or second stage. And when we come to Mercury, we'll do the same thing. Have Mars behind the Mercury, so that the shortest distance from the slower moving planet to the faster moving planet is forward in the zodiac. So they are both first sextile. All right, now we're ready to look at some horoscopes. That's right. No, we've got way too many. And mathematician. There is still to this day is famous in the history of mathematics with that which is called Cardan's theorem. You can see he was born quite a long time ago. I think that's 1501 that he was born. This is somebody that had a very keen mind. If we look at Mercury, Mercury is conjoined the Sun and is trying to Saturn. And that's a penetrating kind of mind. But it's also the Sun and Mercury are also square to Neptune. So there is a little bit of confusion in this. The way this worked is, as a physician, he was very, very accurate in his diagnosis. And with the tools they had for diagnosis at that time, that was, I'd say, quite something. But he was a person who was very abruptly outspoken. Personality is characterized by the first house, and we have Mars and Gemini there, and he's blunt. He's, he's witty, he's intelligent, but he just blabs it all out there. As a result, he made a lot of enemies for himself. And enemies then were a much different thing in the Renaissance than enemies now. It was likely that you would be poisoned to death, or you would be in a duel or something like that. He was confusing, and he was often confused, as indicated by the squares. And he had a lot of misunderstanding. And he had to use the sharp mind to clarify and rectify situations. And so the strengths of the squares combined are very close to the strengths of the trines. So it was, he had a sort of nip and tuck life. In fact, there's indications of all of those kinds in the chart that the positives are just a little bit stronger than the negatives. Now we have Sun and Mercury are in Libra, which rules the kidneys. The ruler of Libra is in Scorpio, which has a lot to do with the bladder. And so we're talking about fluid elimination. And if you look at Jupiter, Jupiter is square to the moon, but the moon is in its own watery sign, Cancer, so he had copious amounts of fluid. He goes at great length when he's talking in his autobiography about how much he could urinate at a time. And so it's like, watermelon for breakfast, I might be emulating him. He went on for several pages. Now, because the Neptune aspects are afflictions, he was basically a negative psychic. But because he had the good focus, he could predict. And you can always tell a psychic, because psychics are great at predicting disaster. They're not very good about predicting positive. That negative receptivity in the personality that draws people to other people's pains. You see these people that run their hands over somebody's body, and they don't, they're several inches above the body. And they never talk about, say, wow, these muscles are well toned, or this organ is strong. They always feel the always, feel the organs that are threatened and such. And that's the nature of negative receptivity. He was so astute in this negative psychism, it was visible. He had a son that was endangered somehow, and on his solar finger, a little red arrow appeared to him. And day by day, it was like a threatening, menacing, bright red arrow. It day by day, it went up to the top of the finger, up toward the top of the finger. And when it got to the very top of the finger, his son was either killed or his son died from something very horrible. So this is an example of what he was. So, you know, like his diagnosis was probably not all just mental looking at the facts. It was mental looking at the facts of negative psychism. Negatives always talk about disaster, and positive clairvoyance or positive sensitive talk about anything. They talk about what you can do with the situation. They don't predict that something is going to happen or something like that. And this we said this horoscope was nipped in tuck. And we're talking about all kinds of side trips. It's the last day, and I think we realize that. He was a very fortunate man. And one day he was walking down the street. And you have to remember, this is Renaissance Italy, and he needed to urinate. And so he took a step to the side, and there was a space in between the buildings, and he starts urinating. And this, off of the facade of the building where he was, a huge big stone went loose and came down, and it was right where he would have been if he hadn't stopped to urinate.
Yeah, that's really
this is a man.
That's Jupiter in the morning.
I don't know if it was in the golden showers or anything like that, but this was a man that had something going for urination.
So that saved his life?
It saved his life.
I'm sure you're accidents
are ruled by Mars and Uranus. But in this horoscope, Mars and Uranus are in sextile. Mars is in the first house, which indicates he's probably prone to accidents. But since it is such a strong good aspect, that sextile, that whether he's prone to accidents or not, he's likely to come out of it very well. Jupiter is usually the protector, and Uranus is also sextile to Jupiter. Well, Mars is in the trine, sorry. And the sextile is between Jupiter and Uranus, and that is the protector. He's protected by these kinds of things that happen. Paul Thomas, position of Jupiter shows that in past lives he has earned this kind of protection. Jupiter sextile to Uranus, which we're taking as a classic, we're looking at the other sextile to Uranus, looking from here to here, rather than from here to here. The Jupiter sextile to Uranus is expansive, expansion, and discovery expansion. And the way this worked for him is that he was capable of taking mathematical ideas and expanding them. Cardan's theorem is something that everybody learns in astrology. It has, and in mathematics, it has something to do with binomials. And he was also the first person to work with complex numbers. So, like, this is somebody that can see things from the two triangles, so to speak. He can expand creatively on ideas from the two different points of view, and that's a good example of an Uranus sextile. Now we'll look at another Uranus person. Emma Goldman has the most leftist horoscope I've ever seen. Certainly, it's far more leftist than Stalin, it's far more leftist than Lenin, and it's much more leftist even than Trotsky's horoscope. You will probably never find anybody as radical as this person is. She was the supporter of the Russian Revolution and all kinds of other communist and humanitarian causes. If you look at this horoscope, Venus is conjoined to Uranus. Uranus is the planet of leftism. And Uranus also sextiles the conjunction of Jupiter and Pluto, showing you even more radical things. And the Uranus-Venus sextile is also sextile to Mars. The conjunction is sextile to Mars. So this is somebody who's really Uranian, really expansive. Not all of the things are positive, because on top of all of those other aspects, Uranus squares Neptune. There's even an inconjunct of Uranus and the Moon, and that's almost exact. It's only about less than 10 minutes apart. This is somebody then that is very, very futuristic, very modern, and very radically different from all tradition. She was a strange idea. She was an anarchist. She was even more radical than all the communists. She said, no government, because she believed the Jupiterian quality. She believed that people were basically good. If you just let them alone, they'll be good. The extreme right thinks that people are basically bad, and that if you just let them alone in lazy affair, that everything will come out right because they're exceedingly bad, and the competition will weed out who shouldn't be there, which is usually the people that the Republicans and the right don't like. That's a strange, when you get to the extreme left and the extreme right, how many things are similar, but for different reasons. She was against all war of any kind. She was against religion, not because she was atheistic, but she actually was atheistic, but she was against religion because it controlled people, and she didn't want people to be controlled. She wanted them to be free. She believed it was to their disadvantage. She was against marriage because she thought that marriage enslaved women, and she believed in free love, and practiced it as much as she could, but she was not a very pretty woman, so she didn't get a lot of opportunities to practice it. She was against democracy, because democracy was too easily controlled by big business. she was really open to things. She went to Russia and saw the revolution unfold, and when she saw what happened after the revolution, she was against Russia. So the Neptunian squares indicate that she was an impractical dreamer, and perhaps so much of an impractical dreamer that she was a little bit deluded. Now the ninth house positioning of the Uranus and Venus shows that she is extremely idealistic. And the sextiles, especially the sextiles of Uranus to Mars, which is the mandalic sextile that we're talking about, show that she was shows that she was willing to take action, radical action. She was arrested many times, and she was jailed for instigating riots and supporting assassins and things like that. The Moon and Venus relations show her compassion. And she was compassionate. She was very positive towards homosexuals. She said, well, that's the way they are. She said, don't bother them. And so you can see that this is somebody that is very, very radical. This is someone that this sextile occurs at the toward the end of the mandalic cycle. And this is somebody who believes in a ripe society, and a ripe society that can now create. It's sort of like saying you start playing music, you know, you first learn your scales and fingerings and things like that, and then you learn little elements of composition, but when you get to a certain point, you can be free of all the rules, and you can create through the rules, or even not use them if you want, if you have a certain kind of a soul age. And this is where Emma Goldman thought all of humanity was, or where it should be. She has the expansiveness through the sextile of Uranus to Jupiter, and so she has all of this social idealism. Now the charts today are very good examples, especially the next chart that we're looking at. This is the horoscope of Escher.
It's
got to
be.
Who is M.C. Escher?
He's an artist. M.C. Escher is an artist, though some people don't consider him so. It'll come out as we talk about it.
Okay.
This is a horoscope that is worthy of a very major study. But we have only a few minutes, so we'll just briefly touch on it. First, there are all kinds of polarities. There are the polarities of all of the planets in Gemini, which is a very polarized sign. And then there are the polarities which are contrast polarities by having all the planets in Gemini opposite the Saturn in Sagittarius. Those are very graphic when Saturn is involved, and when you have the extremes, the unique and the new of Uranus conjoined together with the very old and traditional and the dark qualities of Saturn, you have graphic things made very graphic. So there are a lot of oppositions. There's a lot of contrast. What we're looking at in this one is the Jupiter sextile Uranus, which is almost exact. And this shows an expansion, and an expansion that is creative so that it becomes metamorphic. This is the man that does all those paintings where there will be birds on one side and fish on the other side, and they'll pass through each other becoming blobs, and then they each become each other. You know what I'm talking about? You've all seen all of those kinds of things. And he has that unique perspective of stairways going up they're impossible situations. Stairways going up and stairways coming down, and it is not physically possible, but it's capable of doing that on a canvas. If you like, later on when we're done, I can bring up some of his drawings. There's a very excellent gallery of everything he's done from all the different periods of his life. And it's just amazing how he takes those contrasts and blends them into each other. And for me, it's so wonderful how accurate astrology is. How this horoscope describes all of those contrasts, and then how he can expand the ideas into something much, much bigger. You get all kinds of images, you get all kinds of understandings, and you get more of a feeling of metamorphosis and evolution from his pictures than you get from explanations in science books, because it does something to your consciousness to see one thing change into another thing. Utterly fascinating.
Sort of like a morphism.
Yes. Yes. So, even if things are impossible, a person is still brought back to concretion. And all of this is done both with great detail, but also a sense of vagueness at the same time. I don't know what to say more about it, because the chart is really quite simple, but the principles are very accurate, and it's a very strong strong example of that kind of graphic opposition expanded. All right.
Is there a way of telling when you're looking at certain charts like this, especially of creative people, how that creativity is going to express itself? Like this one expressed itself in art. Would that there be some sort of a
sometimes
Venus
you can
sextile
and sometimes
something?
You can't. I have a series of two talks on when astrology fails. And that is, there are certain things that you cannot tell. There's no astrological technique to tell them. Mm-hmm. For example, take a house, any house, second house, materials. Sometimes it has to deal with the income. Sometimes it has to do with the estimation of the quality of materials. Sometimes it has to do with providence. Sometimes it has to do with responsibility. In some horoscopes, only one of those things will be there. In some horoscopes, different multiples will be there. And in some cases, all of them will be there. But you can't tell. There's nothing astrological that I've ever found. I gave one of these talks at the Astrological Society in San Diego at one time, and nobody had an answer to that. You know, that's unusual for astrologers, because they usually have some kind of gimmick theory that they can answer anything that they're absolutely sure of, but which is not necessarily really true.
So some of the hindsight after you see where they're done.
All right. The next is the horoscope of Jackie Kennedy Onassis. Another universalist expanded to the big set, the jet set. The sun is in Leo. And it's a very strong sun in Leo. And it's expanded by a sextile to Jupiter. Very broad. And the sun is trine to Uranus, which means that Jupiter is also sextile to Uranus, which is again that aspect that we're looking at, expansion to unique points of view or creativity. Now, most of the planets are on the right side of the horoscope, which is the other oriented hemisphere. And that means that no matter what her attitudes are, no matter how positive and assertive Leo can be, the opportunities are such that she must work through others. So she shines for them, and she can shine because of them. and that is very much what her life was like. The sextiles and trines involve the ninth house and the fifth house, which are both houses of publication, and so there's a good deal to do with the publishing industry, which was with what she finally ended up in when she worked, or when she sort of worked anyway. There is an opposition between Saturn and Venus, between the second and the eighth houses. And Saturn-Venus oppositions indicate a, how would you say it? They indicate insecurity about love, whether she can love, whether she does love, and because it's the opposition, there's that back and forth kind of tension. And my thought is that even with Scorpio rising, it's likely that she was pretty close to frigid. And in her insecurity, she was drawn and was capable of using her leonine charisma and her Scorpio sex appeal, she was capable of drawing herself to very wealthy and powerful partners. That's the way, but at any rate, the sextile we're looking at is between Jupiter in the seventh house, which is the partner, and Uranus in the fifth house. And this almost leads one to believe that through marriage she is something of the expansion or the continuation of a dynasty. And the Kennedys were just about to become a dynasty. But this is this is the kind of consciousness that she had in herself. So her being married the way that she was being, her first marriage to Jack Kennedy was almost the way aristocrats had to marry other aristocrats. Her second marriage was out of insecurity, and that was more out of power. So that's all right. Now we're switching to the other aspect. We're looking at the first facility aspect. When we look at the next horoscope, and the next horoscope is one of the most remarkable persons. I'm not going to go into all the details of his life, but they're absolutely fabulous, the things that have happened to this man. We're looking at Mars sextile Mercury, and this sextile also includes the moon, which is conjoined to Mars. This is the man called Les Paul, who was the inventor of the electric guitar. And he was also, but he didn't produce the first electric guitar. He brought it around to all the guitar manufacturers and nobody wanted to make it. Just, I'm talking about the solid body electric guitar. And so somebody else, Leo Fender, came along and they accepted the idea from him, even though the original creation was from Les Paul. Eventually, the very best solid body electric guitar turned out to be the Les Paul guitar. But he did all sorts of other things. This is a man that almost lost his life. I don't know how he did it. He fell into a gorge or something like that, and his spine was crushed and everything else. He's come back from everything. He's done many things. This is a man that is in his mid-90s, and he plays a jazz gig every week in New York City. And he's still innovating. He's still coming up with new. He can barely move the fingers on one hand because of the accidents and such that he's had. But even with that, he's still... Anybody have a...
It's down the block.
I wonder if that's mine.
This isn't school day, is it?
No. Yesterday they had kindergarten.
Yes, it wasn't mine.
For you. But today
is... My battery suddenly went dead. Now, first facility doesn't require a lot of elaboration. It usually isn't very sophisticated, but it has the brilliance of something that's new. Very often you find in composers that they write a piece of music and the original, even though it's more rough than the final versions of it, are much more brilliant because it has that very first idea that the person had. I, for example, am fascinated by Gluck's Orpheus, Orpheus and Eurydice, and there are various versions of it. I still like the first one, the original intent, because it really has the spirit much better than when it was than when it was polished up. This is in the first house. The Mars part of the sextile, and Mercury's in the third house, so this is almost classic just because of the house positioning. So this is very fresh. When you think of vigor and energy together with water, you're thinking of something very, very fresh. So this is somebody who can gush forth with all kinds of raw emotions. And there's kind of a emotional foundation to everything that he's going to do. Now this is something like a fire hose. And if you have a higher pressure fire hose, you better have your feet very well placed. And this is indicated that this is the type of character that is somebody, if somebody's holding a fire hose, because everything is founded in Taurus, which is that really solid, steady, sturdy foundation of things. The first house also indicates early childhood, when things are developed. And from earliest childhood on, this is somebody that had an unbounded enthusiasm. He was always doing new things. I remember him from my teenagers. Remember the records of Les Paul and Mary Ford, where they had that echo chamber effect, waiting for the sunrise? Dear one, the world is waiting. I can still hear that echo effect. He knew how to bring forth new things in such a way that was fresh. So from his enthusiasm, it's like that old statement that comes from the Bible, from the fullness of the heart, the mouth runneth over. And because he gives forth so strong, he has to be very, very swift. And so the sextile between Uranus and Mercury indicates a lightning fast mind. And it's made for expressing or getting out in one way or another, whether it's perfect or not, getting out new creations. And Mercury is in Cancer, so this is like somebody who is water skiing. Zip, 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 it flows really fast. Only he's water skiing behind something like a jet motorboat or something of that nature. So
is this a sextile between Uranus and Mercury, did you say?
Yes. Mars and Mercury.
Mars and Mercury. Oh, okay.
Very fleet, very strong. The Mars-Mercury people are the people who get themselves into trouble with their tongue. They are the people who can say, Roz, you looked at me before I looked at you. This Roz has the fastest tongue east of the Mississippi, maybe a little bit farther on the west of it also. But there's a certain kind of wit that has heat. And you know, like if it's in something like Scorpio, it's extremely sarcastic. But it's always cutting. And it's true. You know, it's again that first facility kind of quality. And so this is what he's capable of, you know, like making little licks of emotions and bringing them into manifestation. This is not a ponderous reflection. No, we're staying way too late. It looks like the last horoscope, which probably nobody else knows. Maybe Susan knows. You know Gary Gaylors? Judith often knows people that other people do not. Gary Gaylors is a very famous psychologist if you are in psychological circles or if you are in circles of society, you know her, huh?
I met her. She has an ex-husband named Duncan.
No kidding.
When she met me, that was what she mentioned.
Oh, yes, she's a very charming and gracious person.
She must have been first in line, huh?
Well, so you've been lucky enough to meet all kinds of people.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a friend that's like that, and for some strange reason, it's usually people who have ninth house things more than tenth house things that meet famous people. I have a friend that has his son and Saturn and several other planets in the ninth house, and he's met Henry Miller, and he met Muhammad Ali, and Muhammad Ali didn't have the Parkinson's and all of that. He meets all these great people. He wants to meet them too, but whether it's arranged or not, he still gets a chance to meet them. I never meet anybody famous.
Oh,
you're famous.
No.
Gary Gay Lucy is a famous psychologist. Scorpio rising shows that she has a deep psychological interest. The rulers of Scorpio are Mars and Pluto, and they are almost exactly in conjunction, and Jupiter is in there at the same time. And they are in the Scorpionic eighth house. So this is somebody that tries to delve into the mysteries of people's consciousness. And since the eighth house is not only a psychological delving, it's a research house. This is somebody who has very much been a researcher into the nature of human consciousness. And she's so deeply studied that the National Institute for Mental Health was originated by her. She's, you know, in psychological circles, she's really well known. Cancer rules cycles, and all those planets are in cycles, so this is one of the first people to study sleep cycles and to believe that we have an invisible body or an invisible being because of what we go through in sleep cycles, so which is another eighth house kind of thing. And for somebody who is a recognized psychologist and a very highly esteemed psychologist, she even dared to study homeopathy and had a psychological basis for it, or a psychological, you might call, mystical basis, because she didn't believe in invisible forces and things like that. The moon rules the desire body, which rules Cancer. So this is somebody who has great interest in motivation, the whole study of motivation. So what we're looking at is first facility, and first facility of Mars, Mercury. All of these planets, but especially Mars, is the closest in orb to a sextile to Mercury. And her first facility is she can take things that are invisible, or she can take things from research, or she can take things that she derives from understanding secrets from invisible things, and she can verbalize them. She may not be a depth psychologist, she's certainly no Carl Jung, but she can put them in words in such a way that she's going to be famous for that, because the Mercury is in the 10th house. Her writings, she doesn't go into all kinds of detail, just enough to get it out. You'd expect all kinds of detail with the verbal part of things, but no, she doesn't get involved all in detail. She does just enough to get it out, to make it clear, and for other people to see it. So we see somebody who is both deep and energetic at the same time, but not too deep in the delving and not too detailed in the expression. I don't know what more to say about it. I don't know what more to say, but we'll just stay anyway. Let's close with the Rosicrucian Student's Prayer. Increase our love for thee, so that we may serve thee better from day to day. For the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer.
Anybody got any questions on any of these?
Just a comment that didn't Les Paul that wasn't there a trine there between his son and his Uranus? And then you were talking about the electric guitar?
Yeah.
Did that
I when I get talking about charts like this, unless it's a really slow thing, I just run things together and sometimes mm-hmm. I make a lot of errors, you know, in that kind of a process. I really don't like doing this kind of astrological work. I much rather do like I do in the intermediate class that's been going on for 8 years. You can have things all thought out and you can carefully delineate it, but you can't do them when you're doing things in the fly like this. Yes?
Are Mars and Mercury particularly different, or why are you using those?
We're doing them because they're mandelic.
Oh,
because
okay.
Mars is here and Mercury is here, and we're saying that we're studying the classic mandelic sextile.
Okay, which is Mars, Mercury, and
there's another
Uranus.
One that is Mars and Uranus, which is a classic, but that's a different kind of sextile.
Oh.
But rather than do it only Mars and Uranus, I wanted to do more with Uranus and Jupiter because I wanted to give the effect of the expansiveness of the sextile. And so I deflected off into that because the sextile always, you know, it's, the trine has a perfection about it. But when one trine is associated with another trine, you take the perfection and you complement it with something else. Like most of my career, I worked with a physicist who was a violinist. And he took his interest in physics and reflected it into acoustics, which is exactly the same thing that happened with Richard Wagner. He was interested in music, especially homophonic music, and his benefactor allowed him to build an opera house. And so his interest in music then was expanded into the architecture for acoustics in order to have the best sounds for producing his operas. Don't worry about other people's operas. Only, I think they only do Wagner operas at their way. They don't want nobody else. And so he built this magnificent opera house for that. Or if, you know, sometimes mathematicians get involved with mathematics, and then sometimes they say, well, maybe this has some practical interests, and then they reflect into physics. Or sometimes physics people go into mathematics. I forget which way, with string theory, I believe, began as a mathematical theory, a special study in mathematics, but then it got reflected into physics and provided an answer in terms of dimension that physicists were looking for.
So basically, all the combinations of aspects in different charts add up to a particular type of personality, and it's like infinite as to possibilities?
Yes. Each person takes those materials and creates different.
Okay, like I took mathematics and beauty or something and put it together into creative dressmaking?
Yeah. But reflecting from one field or expanding from one field to another field is what the sextile likes to do.
A
reflective expansion from one outlook to another outlook.
And what kind of thing represents mathematics?
Well, I was just giving those as examples. Mathematics is, in general, ruled by Jupiter because it is abstract and it tries to get the big picture of things.
Okay, and Jupiter is expansive.
Yes. In fact, if you take string theory and expand it to the entire universe and look at the entire universe as the expression of the Supreme Being, you have the string being.
The what?
That's humble.
The string bean.
Okay. Oh, there is so much here to learn. I can
yes.
see why you have classes that go on for years.
Yes, yes. And I'm just a beginner. Really, in all the classes that I've done, I'm just a beginner.
Which makes us.
You're supposed to learn
yes.
this in one lifetime or many lifetimes.
No, I mean, it all depends on what you're doing. If you're trying to learn everything, it's not possible, I think, to learn everything in one lifetime unless you develop
a spiritual kind of
consciousness.
That's right.
That you can see everything all at the same time. If you have that kind of enlightenment consciousness that you can transcend all ideas and you're just in pure truth, then you can learn all at one time. What is probably better is to get from that area where you can see it all as one at the same time and piecemeal, which means intuition. You have an intuition, and intuition is really a mini enlightenment. And it comes directly from the level of Christ consciousness. And in fact, if you have an intuition and you can dive into it, you can expand into that kind of consciousness. So if you're working with astrology, I don't ponder all of these things with a horoscope. I do a lot of that, but I don't only do that. You know, I'm not pondering hours and hours and hours to try to figure this out, whether it's this theory or that theory. I try to understand what a person is working with, what the you know, what focuses on what they're working with in their life. If they're trying to understand what to do with their profession, or if they hate their brother or something like that, and you focus on those elements, and you basically what you're doing is praying. And you get an intuitive insight of what it means. Sometimes you get it. The more pure you are, and the more you really love and want to help people, the more often you get insights. But you don't always get that. Nobody has a guarantee that they're going to get insights. So you don't have to study all of astrology, just learning a few little things like keywords, and the key words unlock the intuition, and you can get simple answers, or you can get answers very simply by those kinds of techniques, which is intuition.
Okay, so like theoretically, there's some computer setup that would put all these pieces together.
No computer strong enough.
Okay, so what you do is you study people that you know. And so then you can see the things, and that helps to...
That's a very excellent way.
...to take you to something you don't know, so that you can try to intuitively or mathematically or somehow put the pieces together.
Yeah. I don't think that the exclusively intellectual approach to astrology is a good way. I at one time met probably one of the most intellectually oriented scholars of astrology of his generation. And he had all of these very broad theoretical explanations, and if you parse the sentences, they didn't say anything. And basically, he was a bullshitter. And his name was Dan Grudger, and he was probably the greatest, most famous astrologer of the last half of the 20th century. But he was a bullshitter. He didn't, you know, I was in a conversation with him. I was a very young man, maybe 26 years old or something like that. And he was, I was at lunch with him. I had made a friendship with his wife in some workshops I was attending. And so she invited me along, and he came to lunch. And he said things that were factually untrue. But because it was Dan Woodger, you know. But at any rate, there are a lot of people that give you all these big woo-woo theories, and it's always filled with astrological jargon. It doesn't have anything to do with life. Much better to take just a few simple keywords in astrology and use your intuition. The intuition is always going to be accurate if you're getting right.
Yeah, so once you have a few intellectual things, then you turn it over to intuition.
Yeah. Or the other way around.
You're going to get the you're going to get the intellectual things anyway. You start practicing astrology, and you get an intuitive hit that this is the way things are, and then afterwards you think about it, and you can see how it got to be that way, and then the intellectual thing comes afterwards. Too much intellect is like if you're starting a fire in the woods, like a Boy Scout, and you get this little flame, boy, and you don't pull a big log on it, and you smother it. And that's really what happens.
Twigs.
A lot of people smother their intuitive creativeness by too much knowledge. All right.
Do you remember the name of the song? The tune?
Dear one, the world is waiting.